Coming up, she's being called the Speaker in Waiting. But who is Nancy Pelosi, and what might this California congresswoman bring to a Democratic-led House? But first, inside the heavily fortified Green Zone today in Baghdad, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq and the top American general there held a rare joint news conference. They announced that Iraqi leaders had agreed to develop a timeline to stabilize the country and that Iraqi forces should be able to take full control of security in the next 12 to 18 months with some level of American support. General George Casey said he felt the U.S. should continue to focus on drawing down U.S. forces in Iraq. Still, he would not hesitate to ask for more troops if he felt they were necessary to make Iraq more secure.
Do we need more troops to do that? Maybe. And as I've said all along, if we do, I will ask for the troops I need, both coalition and Iraqi.
Joining us now from Washington, Pam Hess, who covers the Pentagon for UPI. And Pam, help us to make some sense of this, because we're hearing both there's a drawdown in place or in plan and also a possible increase in troops.
Yeah, the military has long maintained that the facts on the ground are going to determine their force levels. That's true to an extent. There's only so many troops that we can throw at this problem. We have 15 brigades committed right now. They can go up to about 17 or 18 in a surge capacity, but they can't maintain much higher than that. So when General Casey talks about adding troops, I think what you're talking about is sort of on the margins, between 5 and 10,000 people.
Well, what's your sense of what's happened today? This follows, you know, a week and a half of a storm of debate here in the U.S., reports of the president meeting over the weekend with advisors and analysts. What happened today?
It also follows a very grim assessment that we received last week from a military spokesman about the Battle of Baghdad, right, which has been going on for 4 months.
And the words of President Bush saying that it might be compared in some ways to the Tet Offensive.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's a really good comparison, but what's going on now are a couple of things. On the military side, they're looking at Baghdad and saying, this is the center of gravity. We have to win here or we cannot win Iraq. They are not necessarily going to lose Iraq, but they can't win Iraq without winning Baghdad. So they have this fight that's been going on for 4 months. They've had to throw more troops at it 2 times. They've redone the strategy. So that's causing them some real problems. And they're finding that the places that they have already cleared, they thought of insurgents and sectarian fighters, militias, they've flowed back into. So they're not holding. This is supposed to be clear, hold, and build. They're clearing but not being able to hold it. So that's one problem. That's the tactical side. But this is all coming up against the midterm elections, in which Iraq is going to be a huge deciding factor. For the when the war started, there were about, I think, 60% of the people were in favor of it, 40% were against, and that has flipped. That 20% that has flipped, I think, are the ones that they're trying to affect with this, and they're talking about, you know, the American will to stay and fight. So that's who they're speaking to now, and they're trying to give people a more optimistic sense that this is something that can be won. But the facts on the ground currently are pretty grim, because we are focusing on Baghdad, and Baghdad is not going well.
Well, General Casey said the U.S. is 75% of the way through a process to build Iraqi forces. Do you think that's an optimistic assessment?
No, that's actually about right. But the question is, what metrics is he using? It's trained and it's equipped, and are they showing up to work? But that still means they're a quarter short of what they need to go. It's a long process, and what you have essentially is a military that's maybe 18 months old that are being asked to go into a fight that the United States military, the greatest military in the world, is having a hard time winning. So it's on the one hand, yes, they are getting trained and ready to go, but they're still rookies, and they have a lot of other pressures on them. They have economic pressures, they have tribal pressures, they have family pressures. So there are a lot of moving parts in the Iraqi military side, and we can't expect a one for one replacement.
Well, Pam, you mentioned that there's less than two weeks to go to an election, a midterm election here in the U.S., and it seems as if there's also difficulty on this side of the ocean in language. We heard words like timeline being used today. Yesterday, the White House said it was going to jettison the term stay the course in the context of Iraq. We were hearing from analysts last week they'd already jettisoned that phrase. And yet, in using words like timeline and drawdown and benchmarks, that's the language of the Democrats.
It is, actually. Senator Carl Levin from Michigan has been talking talking about that, giving the Iraqi government some timelines and benchmarks that they have to meet or face some consequences, either the U.S. withdrawal of troops or a reduction in the amount of money. I think the White House is sort of trying to finesse this. The uproar that you see in the press about this is something different, though, from the overarching issue. The issue that you have now with Baghdad being fought, are we winning? What is the military going to do to try and turn this around, is one thing. That's a tactical argument. The other thing is the political argument, and that's what the press is jumping all over, in that the White House has used the phrase stay the course to counter the cut-and-run Democrats and has been bludgeoning the Democrats with that cut-and-run label, and now they're switching their own rhetoric, and so that's why this has become a political story. The rhetoric story, I think, is separate from the military story.
And coming away from this press conference today, at least what you heard, again, what is your sense? Was this an attempt to, stem the debate, reassure, lay out a plan?
I think it's definitely an attempt to reassure people that things are going well, because last week's press conference did nothing to that end. I think it's also a reasonable thing for them to do. If they had this big meeting with the White House, Abizaid, General Pace, Casey, Khalilzad, Rumsfeld, Cheney and Bush all met to figure out what to do about Iraq. So I think it's okay and defensible. It's not necessarily politically motivated to have this press conference if they're saying that this is what we've decided to do and go ahead. But at the same time, it can't be viewed without the backdrop of the midterm elections going and tumbling American support for this war. So nothing's completely clean. But I don't like to tag General Casey with a political label when I think that there's perhaps another explanation for it. That's a very bad thing to say about a military leader.
Pam Hess covers the Pentagon for UPI. Pam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, a poll out today from the Washington Post and ABC News suggests that despite spin from politicians, the midterm election in 2 weeks will be a referendum on Iraq. The poll also shows that Republicans are rapidly losing their conservative base, as well as independent voters in the political center, by roughly 2-1. If Democrats regain control of the House of Representatives, as polls such as that one indicate, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi would most likely become the first woman speaker of the House. Pelosi spoke with 60 Minutes reporter Leslie Stahl in an interview that aired on Sunday, and Pelosi, a grandmother, was described as motherly.
I guess it depends on your definition of motherly. If motherly means we're going to have order in the House, yes, that's motherly.
Well, Democrats say Nancy Pelosi is tough as nails and has kept her party in line over the last 4 years. Republicans call her a scary San Francisco liberal. They say she wants to set up a Department of Peace if she gains control of Congress. And most Americans, they don't have any idea who Nancy Pelosi is. Well, we want to get a portrait of the woman who could be the first woman Speaker of the House. And to do that, we turn first to Washington Post reporter Lois Romano, who profiled Pelosi for that newspaper this past week. And Lois, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And you start your profile by referring to election night 2004. The Democrats once again lost big. How did she respond? And what was something, an exchange that she had that was telling?
Well, it was very interesting because everyone was telling her it was over, that the Democrats would never get traction again, that she needed to accept that she was going to be the leader of a permanent minority. And she just wouldn't accept that. She's very feisty. She's very aggressive. But she also knew that the answers were not within her own house, so to speak. So she reached out and she went to marketing people, internet people, and she basically said, we had to change our environment. And she got their advice on how to do it.
And what did they tell her?
What she asked them was, she said, politics aside, if you had a product that was number two and you wanted it to be number one, what would you do? And they told her three things, that the first thing you had to do was take the product down. And in her view, that was President Bush. Take him down. The second was differentiate. Once you've taken the product down, show everything that your product has that the other product doesn't have. And then lastly, go positive, which is basically a plan. And which the Democrats, have been trying to introduce over the last, 6 months. And they were advised not to try to introduce anything until that the credibility was lost on the other side because nobody would be listening.
Well, is this what does this explain some of the criticism of the Democrats? Because we hear that Nancy Pelosi, you know, following that advice from ad executives, told a lot, you know, many of the Democrats, do not, we don't want a plan. We don't want to have something that we put forward as a Democratic plan because all we want to do is attack President Bush's plan.
Yes, I think that that was part of their strategy, but there was two things going on. I think generally speaking, that was their strategy, and they were advised, don't always try to come up with another plan. Keep the focus on what's going wrong with them, and you will be criticized. You will be under a lot of pressure, such as when they tried to tackle Social Security. A lot of the Democrats wanted to come up with their own plan, and she said, no, their plan is so bad that we've got to keep the pressure on their plan, and she ended up being right on that. The president's public opinion polls slid over a six-month period, and they withdrew their plan. With regard to the war, that's been a little bit more of a slippery slope for the Democrats. I think she took that strategy to the war, but I don't think that was because she thought that was the only strategy. I think partly what happened there is that she couldn't get a consensus in her own caucus. And so she had a lot of lefties saying, you know, pull out now. Right. She had a lot of conservatives saying, no, let's stay the course. And so basically what she did is devolve into the strategy that she was advised to do on the other issues, which is, well, it's their war. They can solve it.
Well, and we're going to see how she's going to wrangle that crowd if, in fact, the Democrats win big in a couple of weeks. But just some biographical details. Nancy Pelosi is 66, been in politics for 20 years, married a wealthy San Francisco businessman, becomes by her political toughness by birth. She was the daughter of a Baltimore mayor. But doesn't project very well, her critics say, on television. She doesn't come across well.
She doesn't. And it's interesting because on a one-on-one, she's very engaging. She's very chatty. She has an enormous amount of energy. But when she's trying to, and I think that's because she's a little unscripted in an interview, but I think when she's trying to give a speech or respond off the cuff, she really struggles. And she's been, well, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that she's more political than she is policy. She knows the policy, but she's not a wonk. And so if you're not a wonk, I think it's very hard to be facile when you're being grilled on certain things. But she's working with media advisors to try to tackle some of that.
Lois, we're going to take a look at how Nancy might be as a Speaker of the House with Michael Isikoff. He's coming up next. But I just want to, in the minute we have left, you say her management style is scorched earth. Scary words.
Well, she's pretty tough. And she basically took over the Democrats. And she, I think that what her friends tell me, although she wouldn't say this, is that she was being dissed a little bit when she first was elected. Some of the guys were not giving her her due. And she put down a marker immediately with her own party saying, you know, I'm the boss, and if you don't do things my way, you're going to be punished. So she first got them in line, and then from there, she was able to tackle the Republicans.
Gee, if a guy did that, he'd be called a tough leader. Lois Romano.
That's true.
Lois Romano, staff writer for The Washington Post, on Nancy Pelosi, the woman who might be Speaker of the House. We're going to hear more from Michael Isikoff when we come back. Lois, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Much more coming up here and now. Conversation about the woman the New York Times today calls the Democrats' speaker in waiting, Nancy Pelosi, the California congresswoman who's led the minority party in the House since 2002. How would she rule if Democrats do return to power in the House of Representatives starting in January? Well, we turn on to Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek. He co-wrote the article, What the Dems Would Do, for the current issue of the magazine. And Michael, you know, the Republicans are making quite a bit of hay out of this already in their ads, picturing Dems led by Nancy Pelosi as, you know, starting an office of the peace. But what you have a list of some of the things that she might do. What would they be?
Well, there's a legislative agenda, of course, and it was sort of fascinating listening to Lois saying that the two of the things that she was advised to do was to be positive, offer an agenda, but then not be too specific about it, because the more specific you are, the more target of criticism your own legislative proposals
right.
should be. And I suppose the Iraq War is the perfect example of where this is the obvious vulnerability for the Bush White House, but the lack of a coherent Democratic alternative is both a blessing and a curse. A blessing because it gives less room for the White House to come back on. But
Nancy, I was going to say Nancy Pelosi might be one of the people to actually be the voice on that issue, because she was one of the Democrats who never voted for the resolution in the first place.
Exactly, whereas her predecessor. As we write about extensively, by the way, in Hubris, the new book I wrote with David Korn on the selling of the Iraq War, Dick Gephardt was the central ingredient that allowed the Bush White House to win congressional passage. Once Gephardt, who wanted to run for president, went over to the Rose Garden to appear by the president's sign endorsing his congressional resolution, all efforts for an alternative resolution essentially disintegrated.
Well, you started to talk about the Dems' agenda. You write it's billed as 6 for 06. It's their version of the contract with America, which the GOP used in 94 to win the House. Tell us, just tick off some of the things that the Democrats plan to enact.
Well, first of all, as we also point out, their ability to enact anything is going to be highly circumscribed. The president will still be in the White House, and he will maintain the veto power. So a lot of this is sort of political window dressing.
Perhaps grandstanding.
Increased prescription drug mm-hmm. reform. All of these are sort of essential parts of the, you know, that most Democrats run on around the country, but are they going to be able to force these through with what's still likely to be a narrow minority, if not in the House, then certainly in the Senate, if they narrow majority, if they win the Senate and have the president there? Not likely. But what is likely and what is certain to happen is aggressive oversight hearings challenging the Bush administration on every level. Document subpoenas, compelled testimony from administration officials, all of which will create a great deal of controversy and media attention.
But she's already signaled that she doesn't want to go too far in that direction. She doesn't want to fall into the trap, with an eye on 08, the Republican trap of appearing too liberal, too punishing, apparently pulled aside one congressman and said not another word about impeachment.
That's right, and I think she explicitly repeated that on TV over the weekend, where she said impeachment is off the table. That's a pledge, and that's true. But that is still does not contradict what is certain going to be the push from all the old Democratic bulls who are going to inherit major committees: John Dingell, John Conyers,
well, let's talk about
Henry Waxman, from holding hearings on a whole range of matters.
But she can still keep them from getting those hearings chairs. I mean, the committee chair, she's been signaling that, you know, unless you fall in line and do as I ask, I may not give you that committee chair.
I don't bet on it. They'll get their committee chairs. She's not going to get in the way of these people. And first of all, Waxman is going to be front and center of it, and she's got no beef with Waxman, fellow California House Democrat. He's pretty savvy. He's going to be able to bang the gavel and hold aggressive oversight hearings. And it's, to some extent, she's not going to be able to control this. She'll have a say. She'll have ability. But, you know, these guys are their own. They're pretty savvy operators on their own. They know how to work, and they fully intend to go down that route.
What about Jane Harman, Congresswoman Jane Harman? We just want to ask you about that, because it was featured in today's New York Times, the idea that they've had something of a spat, Jane Harman and Nancy Pelosi. She is on the Intelligence Committee. A lot of Democrats felt she didn't speak out enough against the Bush administration, and it's said that Nancy Pelosi might keep her from getting the chair of that.
Well, that cuts a little bit the other way, doesn't it? Because Jane Harman was a big supporter of the Iraq War at the time. She has since drifted quite far from that position. But Democrats have a problem with that because the number two, the next in line, is Alcee Hastings, a liberal Florida Democrat on his own with a colorful political past, to say the least. He was a federal judge and was impeached. He's not necessarily the guy that the Democrats would want to have in what is going to be a very crucial position as chairman of the Intelligence Committee if the Democrats win control.
And Mike, we have about a minute and a half left. Some might be saying, wait a minute, I don't remember you speaking this much about Dennis Hastert before he became Speaker. Why is there so much fascination with whether or not Nancy Pelosi will be Speaker?
Because she's a largely unknown commodity to the general public. She will be a new face. She will be third in line for the presidency. Incidentally, when we talk about impeachment, remember, if impeachment were to go down the route that the advocates say, which would be centered on the selling of the Iraq War and the creation of a false reality in 2002 and 2003, Vice President Cheney would be right part and parcel of that. So if you were going to impeach Bush, it would be pretty hard not to do it and also impeach Cheney, which would make who president? Nancy Pelosi. So can she be too forceful and out there in seeming to sanction such a course? Probably not. Another reason she really doesn't want too much talk about impeachment.
Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek. He also co-wrote the article, What the Dems Would Do for the Current Issue, and is author of the book Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin, Scandal, and the Selling of the War. And some might be saying it's hubris to think even this far ahead about Nancy Pelosi being Speaker. But Michael, thanks so much for helping us take a look ahead.
Anytime. Thank you.
Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR
Power, the Julia Child of Indian food. But first, the UN's top envoy to Sudan is expected back in New York tomorrow after the Sudanese president told him to get out of that country. President Omar al-Bashir gave UN Special Representative Jan Pronk 3 days to leave Sudan after Pronk accused the Sudanese army of mobilizing Arab militias in the Darfur region. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says Pronk didn't bow to Sudan's request, but left to take part in talks in New York. Either way, this is the latest clash between the UN and the Sudanese government, which is refusing to allow UN peacekeepers into Darfur. More than 200,000 people have died and 2.5 million people forced from their homes in Darfur in 3 years of fighting between government-backed Arab militias and ethnic rebel groups. Well, for more on the situation there, we're joined by Colin Thomas Jensen, Africa analyst for the International Crisis Group. Colin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, your thoughts on Pronk's exit and how significant it is.
His exit is significant. This is now the second UN envoy that the government of Sudan has attempted to throw out. The last one had made comparisons between Darfur and Rwanda and was asked to leave. Pronk's exit, I think it's pretty clear the government does not want him back. They've essentially said that his time there is over. And the UN now saying that he's being called back for consultations is some not-so-subtle diplomacy and trying to get out of a sticky situation. But I don't expect Jan Pronk to be going back to Sudan anytime soon.
Well, others are saying that this is another example of Sudan thumbing its nose at the UN because President Omar al-Bashir has refused to allow UN peacekeepers into Darfur as well. There are 7,000 poorly equipped and pretty ineffective African Union peacekeepers there. But Bashir says UN troops would be Western colonization and has vowed to personally lead the jihad against them.
Bashir, in employing the language of jihad, is clearly trying to frighten away the West, to scare them off from responding aggressively to what is, in essence, a government's wholesale liquidation of its own population.
Well, and let's take a further look at why, you know, the U.S. isn't saying more. Bashir's language reflects a fear, you know, calling for a jihad, reflects a fear that Sudan might become a radical Islamist state. It is a country that harbored Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden lived in Khartoum. Explain that relationship.
The ties between the ruling party in Sudan and bin Laden go back a long way. He was essentially allowed to set up shop there operationally and commercially in the early 90s. He lived there for over 5 years. He was supported by the government of Sudan, who also had relationships with a number of other terrorist networks. And it was really when sanctions were placed on Sudan by the Security Council and by the U.S. government under the Clinton administration, that Sudan began to turn and to become a partner with the U.S. on the war on terror. Now, this accelerated after 2001, after 9/11, when they saw the consequences for cooperating with terrorists. But it's an open question as to how accurate and up-to-date the information that they're providing us is now.
Well, if information about Osama bin Laden may not be all that accurate, why else is Sudan considered an ally in the war on terror?
Well, the most pressing need right now for the U.S. on counterterrorism concerns in Africa is the deteriorating situation in Somalia. U.S. policy had essentially been to back warlords in an attempt to capture a small number of al-Qaeda affiliates in Somalia. That strategy backfired. Islamists have taken control of much of southern Somalia, and the people in charge of Somalia now have direct links and close ties to the government of Sudan. So Khartoum is a valuable interlocutor for the U.S. and the people currently running the show in Somalia.
Well, you mentioned the sanctions, and U.S. sanctions have been pretty ineffective as well. We read the article on the front page of the New York Times today about how many other countries are enjoying a huge trade boom with Sudan, in large part because of the trade of oil. So given that the sanctions don't seem to be working, what incentive is there for Sudan now to stop the genocide in Darfur?
There's different types of sanctions, and the sanctions that have essentially pushed Sudan and Sudan's government into the arms of the Chinese and the Russians and other Asian oil companies are broad-reaching economic sanctions. What we're looking to do now is really to change the calculations of the senior officials within the government of Sudan, and the way to do that is through what are called targeted sanctions, sanctions that go after individuals and companies owned by individuals that have high positions within the regime.
Colin Thomas Jensen, Africa analyst for the International Crisis Group. We began by talking about the UN envoy kicked out of the country by the Sudanese government because he was writing on his blog about the fighting in Darfur and how bad it was getting, and he seemed pretty angry about it. How bad is it in Darfur?
Well, it's quite bad at the moment, in large part due to the government's launching of a major offensive. They've decided to, in their words, to consolidate the peace by implementing the peace deal through force of arms. The Janjaweed, the militia that the government of Sudan used to essentially ethnically cleanse Darfur, enjoy a state of impunity, and they've been promised war booty. They can essentially loot whatever they want, and the government said that they can keep it. Now that Darfur has been widely cleared and destroyed, those same militia have moved into eastern Chad and are currently attacking a large number of villages and civilian populations there.
Colin Thomas Jensen, Africa analyst for the International Crisis Group. Colin, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And this note, the women of Darfur have been especially victimized. Many have lost their husbands, been raped, beaten, seen their children starve, and all this after they made it to displacement camps. Well, one music college here in Boston found a way to reach out to the women of Darfur. We Are All Connected is a collection of songs composed and performed by students and musicians at Berklee College of Music. Sales of the CD benefit the women and children affected by the war. Farrar Siraj was born in Jordan and grew up in Spain. In this song, she sings, "There is so much strength in the eyes of these women. They have been through so much, and they must know that they are beautiful. We have not forgotten you." A delegation of aid workers and philanthropists from Boston traveled to the Darfur displacement camps, and to honor the African tradition of giving a gift to your host, they played songs from We Are All Connected. When the music finished, one woman from Darfur was quoted as saying, "When we see you coming, we feel so ashamed, we are dirty and poor. But when we hear you singing, you have captured our emotions, we are no longer ashamed." To find out more about We Are All Connected, visit our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Napoleon once said that an army marches on its stomach. Well, just outside Boston, nutritionists at a military base take that motto seriously, albeit with a grain of salt. Nina Mitchell has our story.
They say that in the army, the chow is mighty fine.
A chicken jumped off the table and started marking time.
From chicken a la king to chipped beef on toast, army food has long been the brunt of jokes, most of which I can't repeat on the radio. Since 1963, the recipes have been cooked up here at the Combat Feeding Center in Natick, Massachusetts, where food technologists like Michelle Richardson have been testing everything from sea rations to spiked energy bars for all branches of the military. And they're still trying to get it right.
Right now, this is an omelet that they get in the field, and it has vegetables in it, and that doesn't look like something your mother has cooked. This is like a tin rectangular patty with like bits of vegetables in the middle of it. It doesn't look very appetizing. Like I say, it's tan, and I've never seen tan eggs.
Yeah, someone said that they were scrambled eggs that were green at one point.
Well, yeah, that was years ago, but they've added the ingredients to prevent the greening. And the new concept is bright yellow scrambled eggs.
Now, the idea of a plate of bright yellow scrambled eggs may not be new to you or to the short order cook at your local diner, but try having to make 3.2 million of them a year, dehydrate them, and stick them in a shrink-wrapped bag that will last, well, just about forever. Joanne Sharp says they're called MREs, Meals Ready to Eat.
We're working with 2 instant puddings that rehydrate with water, and we're also looking at 5 potential entree items.
MREs are the equivalent of Armed Forces TV dinners, eaten 3 times a day on missions where a proper mess hall just isn't an option. Right now, soldiers are eating identical meals on missions all around the world.
This is food source, and this is a banana cream pudding, and then we have a butterscotch pudding. The major thing that we look for is that it rehydrates, because this is something the soldier has to add water, and the product should rehydrate itself so that it's not clumps of powder in the product.
I think they're both a little bit artificial tasting.
Yeah, well, they are.
Well, yeah.
They are artificial. It's not real butterscotch, and it's probably not real banana, so you kind of forfeit that to get a product in that they're going to eat.
The food lab here looks like a kitchen for giants. Kettles are big as bathtubs. The mixer holds 80 quarts. The scale is big enough to weigh an entire calf. And scurrying around are the food technologists in their white lab coats and what look like shower caps on their heads. Most of the technicians are civilians, but Sergeant First Class Celeste Burnett's combat boots stick out under her lab coat. She served in Afghanistan and Iraq before coming here. She works on the lab's newest concoction. She calls it First Strike Rations.
It's a 3-day supply that's condensed into 1 package versus 3 big MREs. If you don't have time to heat that food, it could hinder your mission. So therefore, we want to make sure that the soldier has the energy to do what he has to do without having to stop and heat his MREs.
It's food you don't need to heat to eat, like tuna fish and zapplesauce. Applesauce with extra carbohydrates. These easier-to-carry meals will be unveiled next month, so subcontractors can get busy producing them for the troops. As you wander around the kitchen, you begin to appreciate all the nutty thinking that goes into feeding people at war. But the strangest food of all was shown to me by technologist Al Barnett.
These kettles along this side, they use to mix up product, which go into the tube foods. But it's a ration that's in a toothpaste tube. And what they are used for is reconnaissance aircraft or high-altitude flights where they cannot take off the face and the head shield. So they have to be able to consume a meal, okay, while they're flying with the pressurized suit on.
On the menu at 70,000 feet, chicken pot pie with the consistency of runny toothpaste, seafood chowder, and my favorite, chocolate pudding with caffeine.
Our story on new food for the military was produced by Nina Mitchell. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Cookbook author Madhur Jaffrey demystified Indian cuisine with An Invitation to Indian Cooking and Madhur Jaffrey's World Vegetarian, both books winners of the Food World's James Beard Awards. She's also an actress, appearing in last year's Prime with Meryl Streep. In her new book, Climbing the Mango Trees, Madhur Jaffrey shares family recipes as well as the story of her childhood and adolescence. She grew up in a well-to-do Hindu family in Delhi and Kanpur in the 30s and 40s. And as she writes, her childhood often had an idyllic quality.
As grown-ups snored through the hot afternoons in rooms cooled with wetted, sweet-smelling vetiver curtains, the unsupervised children were on every branch of every mango tree, armed with a ground mixture of salt, pepper, red chilies, and roasted cumin. The older children on the higher branches peeled and sliced the mangoes with penknives and passed the slices down to the smaller fry on the lower branches. We would dip the slices into our spice mixture and eat, our tingling mouths telling us that we had ceased to be babies.
Madhur Jaffrey reading from her book Climbing the Mango Trees. But there was also a shadow over her life in India, first British rule, and then as the country gained its independence, it was split in two, forming India and Pakistan. Recently, Madhur Jaffrey spoke with Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst about her book, her life, and their shared love, good food.
As your reading shows, spices really played a huge role in your memoir. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the role spices play in Indian cuisine.
When an Indian child is born, you don't have very spicy foods, and you don't start eating spices until the age of 3 or 4. But what happens is that as soon as you start, you fall into this great world of spices, where Indians are magicians with spices. We know how to get 20 flavors out of one spice if we want to. We can use them as we want to. We can color them as we want to. The spices that are used in India are used in a particular way in each family, but they're used for two reasons. They're used for the flavor, that is the flavor of the area, of the family, and they're also used medicinally. For example, no beans were ever cooked in our family, dried beans or split peas, without asafoetida. Now, asafoetida is a digestive. It's supposed to cure even horses of indigestion. So that's why it was actually used. But the truffle-like flavor of asafoetida then was something that I will always associate with split peas.
I particularly love the descriptions of your early school lunches in Kanpur. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, Indians are brought up, Hindus particularly, were always brought up thinking that anything from the outside is unclean. So food must come from your home. So even when we were in school, the car would drop us to the school, go back, then it would return at lunchtime with a bearer, we used to call them, who would bring the lunch in a tiffin carrier, which was the lunch box in several tiers. And it could be lovely rice pilafs and meatballs, or if my father had gone hunting, it could be duck curry. It could be all kinds of wonderful things, but it would be home cooking that would arrive at lunchtime nice and hot.
A far cry from the American school cafeteria.
Absolutely.
You also describe in the book that you almost failed your school exams because part of an exam was to cook an Indian meal. And in school up to that point, you had only been taught British dishes like blancmange and puddings. But then when you left India at the age of 19 to go to theater school in London, you really couldn't cook Indian food. And then, interestingly enough, you became a cookbook author, among many other things. Can you talk about that transition of not knowing?
I was raised with people who cooked. We had cooks who cooked. So I never needed to cook. Anything that needed improvement, my mother saw to that. And there I was in foggy, smoggy London town, as it were, not knowing how to cook anything and desperate for good Indian food. That was my form of homesickness, really. I wanted my own food from my house. So I wrote to my mother. And I said, I can't make tea, I can't make rice, what do I do? And she sent me little air letters with recipes. But they were not detailed recipes. There were 3 or 4 lines for each dish, like a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But I had obviously remembered the taste.
The memory of
the
taste.
The memory of the food was there, the flavors was there. So I was able, with her help, to recreate a lot of the dishes, and that's how I got into the world of cooking.
Well, you mentioned this a bit when you were talking about spices, but I wondered if there's a single taste or smell that brings you home.
You know, just as an American child My husband, for example, who's American, will tell you that bacon, the smell of bacon coming from the kitchen downstairs, is an all-important smell for him. For me, it was the smell of boiling basmati rice. It has its own smell. And that, to me, is lunch is cooking. It's, you know, I'm hungry.
Brings it all back.
Yeah.
You grew up in India at a really fascinating time. You were there before independence from the British and then during the often painful break for independence. This coincided with your adolescence, which I find fascinating, as if you and India were becoming adults at the same time.
We were not only becoming adults. You see, India was a British colony. And then when we got our independence, which we were fighting for, but nonviolently, because it was all Gandhi's way that was being followed by certainly people like us. At the same time, India was partitioned by the British into two pieces. Pakistan was formed and India. So we were split into two. And at that age, when I was really, really a sensitive, insecure 12-year-old, it was very hard. And I keep saying that no one's country should be split into two, because the heartbreak of that never goes away. It's as if your heart was torn asunder. And suddenly, in my class, I had half the class was Muslim, half the class was Hindu, and the Muslim girls just left. And it was a horrible feeling that they are going into a void that I will never go into, because I don't know the world they're going into. I won't probably be allowed into that world.
And yet you both started in the same place.
And we started, we were so similar in everything.
Well, your path took you, in addition to being a cookbook author, are a highly acclaimed actress. You've appeared in films like Shakespearewala and Heat and Dust. I wonder how these two worlds of food and a cookbook author and being an actress, do they merge for you?
You know, I know so many actors who can cook well. So I think it's the same side of the brain that is functioning. But anyone who's an actress or not has to cook. I wasn't satisfied with just ordinary food. I wanted the food I wanted. And that, the only way to get it is to cook. So I would have always cooked, but the fact that I became known for this is really, I was drag kicking and screaming into this world of food. I didn't choose it at any point.
It wasn't your path.
It wasn't my path. I just couldn't get work as an actress. I think that's how it all started. And so I started writing, which I sort of could do. My first article, I wrote one article about food, and the rest is just, it went on and on then.
My last question for you is, how do you convince the American audience? People are fearful because so many Indian recipes call for so many ingredients and so many spices and ingredients they don't have on hand. How do you convince someone to start cooking Indian?
I always tell them, pick one dish in my book. One dish. You pick one dish, get only the spices for that dish. Don't think, okay, now I'm setting up this whole palette. You're not. Then you cook that with something else. Make a salad to go with it, or a simple rice to go with it.
Something familiar.
Yeah, something familiar. And then make it a few times. Then add to it with one more dish and get the spices for that dish. And when you are putting spices into a dish, you can throw in one or you can throw in 10. It doesn't take more time to do it. They may be unfamiliar, but if you familiarize yourself slowly with them, you'll have no trouble.
That's Madhur Jaffrey speaking about her book, Climbing the Mango Trees, A Memoir of a Childhood in India, with Here Now's Kathy Gunst. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.